I'm going to open up the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And just want to go over the agenda for today, Tuesday, April 7th. Committee members will be doing the work sessions first for Senate Bill 571 and Senate Bill 739. Senate Bill 103, if that's on our agenda, has been carried over until Thursday. We're waiting for the paperwork on that one. And then we will do Senate Bill 763 first, and then we'll do a joint hearing, actually, on Senate Bill 742 and Senate Bill 320. And then we'll last do Senate Bill 843. Okay, so with that, I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 571. Beth, if you can tell us about the amendments, please, and remind the committee about Senate Bill 571.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Senate Bill 571 establishes that releasing or attempting to release any live fish that was not taken from that body of water is a Class D felony. There's an amendment in front of you, the Dash 2 amendment, that establishes that it would be a Class C felony if the violation is committed intentionally or knowingly, or a Class A misdemeanor if the violation is committed recklessly or with criminal negligence. Establishes that a person is prohibited from applying, obtaining, or possessing an angling license or tag in the future for 5 years if convicted. There is a no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued on the bill.
Okay, and then Senator Przanski, since this was your bill that you worked with former State Representative Susan Morgan on, I know you worked on the amendment, so if you'd like to say a couple words.
Madam Chair, Beth pretty well covered it. Basically, based on the conversation and discussion we had here, we've broken out what the penalties would be for those who are willful, intentional, knowingly doing what they're doing is going to be a higher standard for sanctions as compared to someone that recklessly or criminal negligently does it. The other thing is, Beth said on line 22, we needed to put in what would be the length of suspension or prohibition from having an angling license or tag, and it was decided based on looking at some different areas that 5 years was appropriate, so it's not a lifetime ban or one that seems to be out of the ordinary, but one that does have some sanctions from participating in those type of sports or activities.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So I'll accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2s into Senate Bill 571.
Okay. Senator Przanski moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated April 2nd, 2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 571 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 571 as amended with the Dash 2s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. And Senator Przanski, would you like to carry the bill?
It would be my honor. Thank you.
We'll carry the water on this one, right?
Yeah, yes. I got the water.
We'll make sure that there's some good fishing questions going on there. Okay, next is we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 739. Beth?
Senate Bill 739 requires that upon accepting an offer, the seller of any real estate that includes a well so that supplies groundwater for domestic purposes have the well tested for arsenic. The committee members, and also in the back of the room, there is an amendment in front of you, the Dash 1 amendment. Basically, this changes the language to authorize the department to adopt rules to require additional tests for specific contaminants in specific areas of public health concerns. Requires the seller to submit the results of the test to the buyer within 90 days of receiving the results. There was a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And I'm going to ask Gail Shibley from the Department of Human Services to come up. And for the record, if you can just tell us a little bit about the amendment.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator for the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. The amendment deals with a couple issues that that Chair and members heard identified at the public hearing to clarify in terms of the timing of sharing the information of the test results so that there's not an issue of possibly holding up or otherwise getting in the way of a real estate transaction, but instead there are 3 months, basically 90 days from the time of receiving the validated test results for the seller to provide those test results to the buyer. Secondly, the proposed language in terms of being able to more nimbly identify and begin to contain, deal with any additional contaminants was also clarified and tightened up by agreement of the parties, and I think it's accurate to say that we're all happy with the results.
Okay, and I appreciate you working closely with the realtors to address their concerns. I know that they had concerns about the bill, and I appreciate them coming forward and agreeing to work with you on that. So unless there are any questions on this. You have a question?
Yes.
Okay.
So on the amendment,
mm-hmm.
which I'm looking for, thank you.
There you go.
So the amendment will give you rulemaking authority and the ability to go and ask for other tests, correct?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Atkinson, that is correct. If we went by going through legislative rulemaking, which is kind of, in other words, with the force of law kind of rulemaking, with public notice, comment, et cetera, tightening that up to specific contaminants in specific areas, and this is what that language gets to.
Can you give me a case in point where you'd think this might be necessary?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, you may recall that Greg Pettit, who runs the laboratory for the State Department of Environmental Quality, testified at the last hearing that that currently there are really just a couple very formal designations that allow for this authority now. If you read the current statutory language now, we do have authority now, but only in areas of groundwater concern or groundwater management areas. Those require a very formalized process, specific delineation, mapping, et cetera, and it's a very slow and costly process to do. This, for example, would allow us to pick on an area that I just drove through on the way here, just outside of Kaiser. We know that there are some, there's a TCE plume. We're not sure exactly where it is or just what its delineation is or if it's migrating or how quickly it may be migrating. But we know that because of the community water systems that are required to test. What we don't know is if or how much private wells may be impacted by that. And so just as an example, it's the kind of issue that would allow us to put our scientific heads together, so to speak, and identify, is this appropriate to, in this particular area, for this particular contaminant, at the time of a real estate transaction, to add a TCE to that list.
One more follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
My concern with this is that it could be used to go after somebody. I'll give you, for instance, so you've got a piece of property that's, maybe it's a commercial piece of property, and it's going to be sold, and maybe the neighbors are upset or whatnot, and they call you up and they say, well, I think they've got a leaky gas tank or something, and we think it's affected our water. Does that kind of a phone call trigger you after you get all your rules made to go after and start looking deeper? At a potential sale?
Pardon me. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, no. What we are focused on, what we are concerned about from a public health standpoint, is based on the data that community water systems, public water systems, are required to test for 91 contaminants under the Safe Drinking Water Act. This current statute is for private wells is 2. We're talking about adding a third, and what we may be talking about is there an additional piece that, depending on the specific specific circumstances as a result of the findings that we already have from nearby community systems and based on hydrogeology of the area and other data that we have available. It's not specific to an individual property. We deal on a population basis.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Gail. Appreciate your work on this. Okay, I will accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the, I believe it's the
dash one.
It's in the Senate Bill 739.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 2nd, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 739 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 739 as amended to the floor with the dash ones with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Down here.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I'm quite supportive of the arsenic. I'm quite of banning arsenic and quite supportive of the notification, but I'm not supportive of the broad rulemaking authority, so I'll be a no vote.
Okay. Thank you. I would like to just mention that I was very pleased to see the department bring this forward. I think this is an important bill. As was noted, for municipal water supply, the Safe Drinking Water Act requires testing of up to 91 contaminants. We are now adding one more, so now we're going to have three for domestic wells. And I think that it is part of our job in the state to protect public health. I think this is a good common sense bill. Consumer protection and public health protection, and glad to see that we're able to move forward with it. So with that, I will ask clerk to call the roll.
Senator Moquin?
No.
Senator Pomaski?
Aye.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Vice Jackson?
No.
Aye. With that, the motion passes, and I will carry the bill. Okay. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 739. And next, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 763. And Beth, if you can provide an overview of the bill, please.
Senate Bill 763 authorizes the Department of Land Conservation and Development to implement a system for buying and selling transferable development credits to encourage landowners to voluntarily protect resource lands. There's also written testimony that has been provided for you.
Okay, thank you. And I know, is Senator Schrader here? Oh. Senator Schrader is petite like me, so it's hard to see it, and she's in the second row. And also, I'd like to invite the department, Bob Rindy from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and Kate Kimball from Thousand Friends. It'll be our first panel. Welcome.
Good afternoon, colleagues.
Afternoon.
For the record, I'm Senator Martha Schrader from Clackamas County, District 20. Today I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 763. This is a measure that will authorize governmental units to establish a system for implementing transfer development credits, and we hope provide an opportunity for local TDC programs here in Oregon. Just some simple background on TDCs. They are somewhat complex, but I'm going to try and give you a quick thumbnail sketch. They are intended to reduce development potential in places that could be preserved, for example, resource lands, by increasing development potential in places where growth is wanted and may make sense, particularly with proximity to services. Places ID'd to be preserved are called sending sites, and the owners of sending sites can choose to record a perpetual easement on their land in return for a marketable commodity called transfer development credits. Participating landowners are compensated by selling TDCs to developers in TDC receiving areas, places that are deemed more appropriate for growth. The receiving areas may offer additional development potential when a developer purchases TDCs. The intent of Senate Bill 763 is to establish a framework for the establishment of a TDC system within and in complement to the Oregon land use system. At this point, I presented some of you on the committee with some proposed amendments. They are in the Ledge Council as we speak. And this was actually from a working group of stakeholders. including Thousand Friends of Oregon and the department, DLCD. There seems to be consensus on the amendments. It's still somewhat a work in process. But if I may, I'd like to give you just a brief overview on the sections of the bill that are qualitatively very similar. And that is Section 1 of the bill essentially establishes TDC objectives and potentially, perhaps, a pilot project that's going to be, that's a little bit in play right now, and we'll see how that moves forward, if it moves forward. Section 2 sets forth a series of definitions, conservation easements, government units, receiving areas, etc. Section 3 essentially sets forth benefits for resource landowners and developers and further clarifies the overall TDC framework for local government, including the local nexus to land use rules. And Section 4 sets forth the task to DLCT to develop rules for the programs and identifies cooperating agencies, Department of Ag, State Forestry, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Department of State Lands. So that's just a brief thumbnail sketch of the bill. As I said, it's a work in progress at this point. We'd like to have the opportunity to thank you for opening up this as a public hearing with the intent, we hope, of coming back in a work session with proposed amendments. So with that, I will defer to two individuals who are with me, sitting with me today, who are truly the technical minds behind the bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I do want to acknowledge some assistance from my colleague, Catherine Daniels, who picked a bad time to be on vacation, I think not knowing this bill would be up today. Catherine has worked in other states and has set up TDC programs, and to that degree, we are very fortunate at the department to have her as a resource and some of the background and knowledge that she has. We did give you a short overview of this. By we, I mean myself and Richard Whitman when we first introduced ourselves at the beginning of the session. Because there is a bill that DLCD has put forth in the House, House Bill 2228, which is our version of, I think, three versions of TDC bills that are here this session. And DLCD's version was drafted with the intent that we would try some things out as a pilot project on transfer development credits. We want to think out of the box in part because this is a new program for Oregon. Oh, in the sense that what we want to try to do here has probably not been tried on a large scale before, and we did want to try some things primarily intended to conserve timberland for forestry uses with understanding of the threats that we're hearing from our sister agency, Department of Forestry, for a lot of the state's private timberland. We also would like to try out some other pilots, and we had put those in there. That said, we were part of a working group that during the interim chaired by Representative Roblin, included Representative Clem and Senator Boquist, I believe, on a different bill, 2081, which is really a more broad sort of unveiling or rolling of TDCs and trying to work it into the statewide land use program. And I think that bill is very close to Senate Bill 763. We've tried as a working group to basically combine the two, and that's the amendments that were referred to a little bit earlier today. I think we are in general agreement on a lot of the concepts for this. We do still have some disagreements on some of the pilot projects or the way that bill is being set up, and we're trying to work those out. In fact, I know that Director Whitman emailed a version of that combined bill to the House Land Use Committee, and I believe it was after midnight, or we I would even I haven't even had a chance to go through it all myself. So we're still working, trying to assemble these bills. I think transfer development credits is something that should be part of the Oregon land use system. Under that system, lands that have development rights, landowners may sell those development rights, have them transferred to some other area where someone would purchase those rights and develop. And that would be a market-based voluntary system for conserving farmland, forest land, natural resources, lots of other kinds of areas that we conserve today. We think it may be difficult to find a lot of room inside urban growth boundaries in Oregon that conceivably could accommodate all the development credits that all of us might want to have transferred. That's the rub with this program. Inside urban growth boundaries, we have spent probably the last 20 years at LCDC trying to encourage local governments to increase densities, to try to infill and do a lot of things that mean there generally is not a lot of room in those boundaries to accommodate all the development credits that we might like to transfer. And for that reason, we wanted to try some other areas as receiving areas. That's the nature of our pilot program. But I'm getting away from this bill, which doesn't have that in it right now. So I guess to conclude, we're still working. I think we're really close on a set of amendments. And they're probably pretty complex if you think this is complex. And so I think the last pass we need to make at those is to try to simplify them in the very short period of time you have and get them to you. But I look forward to finishing that and bringing you something along with 1,000 Friends. And by the way, Dick Benner from Metro has been working closely with us on that project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Kimball, and I'm here on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We strongly support Senate Bill 763, and I want to set a little bit of the context as well. Senator Bocas was on part of the working group that Mr. Rindy referred to, and out of that came House Bill 2081. 763 makes a few changes from that, but both bills are generic transferable development credit authorizations. And we think that's a real priority because in Oregon we've already set up sending and receiving areas, which is some of the most difficult work to be done for a transferable development credit system. Equally importantly to us, there is federal matching money that's available for a transferable development credit system to protect working farms and ranches, and we would like to see Oregon take advantage of that program more than its limited participation in the past. We think transferable development credits are important because we think they're an additional tool that can help make land use planning more effective. And in 763, for example, one of the changes is that transferable development credits can be used within an urban reserve. Mr. Rindy talked about maybe there isn't enough credits in an urban growth boundary. Well, 763 allows you to use an urban reserve to help generate some of the interest in those credits to make a system work, and we think that's a very important change. We are in discussions on the pilot project. We would like to see a pilot project demonstrate how land use planning works well with development transferable development credits, not despite it. We're still working on that. If I had to choose, I'd say my top priority is please give us the generic authorization for transferable development credit system. I think we really need it, and I would really like to take advantage of those federal matching funds if possible. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah, I have a quick one for whoever wants to answer it. But I first learned about, the question is there any difference between as far as TDCs and transfer development rights, TDRs, or is it basically same concept, you're just calling it something different?
Chair Dingfelder, it's the same concept, and I think it's almost a coin toss as to which to use. We've seen them both used. Oregon statute already has a very small section that I believe uses the word credits.
It does.
Okay, so that's why you called it credits. Because I first learned about this 25 years ago in planning school, and my understanding is many other states utilize this tool. And so the question is, because we have urban growth boundaries, is that why it hasn't been used extensively in Oregon before? I mean, besides the fact that you needed to expand our existing authority, it's just not been the market for TDRs, TDCs?
I'd say in general that's right, because land use planning system is so comprehensive it hasn't been used very much. It was used in Deschutes County, the southern part of county, due to a sanitation problem there. So we have used it. We would just like to see it applied more broadly. And we think current law is basically a paragraph. And by providing a little more detail, we hope to interest state and local governments in participating more fully.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, I think one of the reasons I became interested in this in the particular was because I had an opportunity to serve as part of the Core Four. I'm no longer serving in that capacity, and that is the metro region with Washington County, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, our communities and our cities, to look at the notion of implementing urban reserves. And that was legislation that was passed last session, enabling legislation to move forward with that process. And it seems to me that this opportunity, as you mentioned, gives us some opportunities to use those in what could potentially be designated urban reserves as that process moves forward. So I think the timeliness of it, given some of the other changes that are happening, is good at this point in time. And I do have a list of some of the states where this has been used: Washington, New Jersey, Maryland, Florida, Colorado, California, Minnesota, Maryland, Idaho, Nevada, and so on and so forth. So, yes, this is not a new tool. It has been used in other areas of the country.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll call the next panel up. And thank you again, Senator, for bringing this forward to the committee. Peggy Lynch and Nan Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League has long been an advocate for our statewide land use planning system. As a part of the Big Look Task Force work, we heard proposals for solutions to addressing the need to assure that our farm and forest lands remain viable economic engines while recognizing that there is development pressure on some of these lands. We also heard about the need to find tools to save our important natural areas. We are hopeful that the work being done on this legislation will lead to a viable solution. It is important that any solution not create new enclaves of urbanism in rural areas, but the cost of both physical and social infrastructure is too great to allow such development. So we want to make sure that those transfer of credits can occur in small rural towns, but not out in our rural areas. I want to share with you really quickly, since I lived in or had property in the Deschutes area and watched the system that occurred there. The lots were essentially unbuildable due to the water table and to the septic issues. So what occurred was, and what has happened today, is people can continue to visit their property, to fish from the banks and enjoy that property while they built in what is now the new city of Lapine. So it worked, and it was a great solution to help with a very serious sanitation issue, frankly one that is still ongoing in the Deschutes area. So we encourage you to work on this legislation to allow Oregonians to voluntarily protect our resource lands and special natural areas. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nan?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and the committee. I'm Nan Evans with the Nature Conservancy, and I, too, would like to recognize the conversations that Senator Boquist and Representative Broblum and Clem and ourselves participated in during the summer. The Nature Conservancy has, as well, long suggested that we need a broader set of tools in our land use program, and particularly more sets of tools that recognize market efforts. And we do broadly support a bill that further defines and clarifies the use of transferable development credits in Oregon. That said, I would make a couple of comments, and I know there has been several sets of amendments, and I really haven't had a chance to look at all of those, but a couple of comments regarding the one of the goals of the bill, which is to protect wetlands, riparian areas, wildlife corridors, etc., and to suggest to you that a little bit more work needs to be done to make sure that, in fact, happens. We would like to see language included, and I believe there is some language in one of the proposed amendments that would clarify that receiving areas within inside UGBs cannot be areas that have been identified as either conservation opportunity areas through ODFNW or identified by the local jurisdictions as being an important natural habitat. We'd also like to see some thought giving to the sending area designations where a landowner of land within one of these conservation opportunities areas identified by the Department of Fish and Wildlife or identified by a local jurisdiction could sell an easement to protect habitat. So it's arguing that it's a great. This is a great concept. We'd like to see it strengthened with respect to habitat. And then just a couple more quick comments. I think successful TDR systems around the country share that they are extremely flexible. They must evolve and adapt over time as people learn them. They must be designed by the users. They must be have the support of the communities at the local level. And with respect to conservation easements, the language says that any government entity or nonprofit can hold such an easement. I just want to make a note that holding an easement brings with it a lot of responsibility under federal law to monitor those easements and to enforce them. So it is, in fact, a fairly complex thing to do. Spoken by an organization that holds those things. One other point is that capitalizing a bank to do transferable development credits is a very complex and very significant activity. But just with those kind of generic comments, we do support the bill. We would like to see more work done on it and would look forward to that opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did work on the interim work group, and so I got a question for both ladies. And as Peggy knows, once you get on these work groups, unfortunately, whether you agree or not, you end up voting for these things, whether you, because it's part of the process. And that's really the question I have from both of you, because it's part of the process. I know that that Arnie Roblin and Brian Clem signed on to the original 763. And, of course, the work group bill, whether we all agree or disagree with everything, is 2081. And then we had LCDC, and I think, as you both know, LCDC told us two-thirds of the way through they were going to do their own bill anyway. So we now have three competing groups out there. Which one of these do you perceive is closest to the intent of the work group? Or are we hoping maybe even to get this one closer to the intent of the work group? Because I know that you didn't say you supported it. You said it needed work.
Right. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, I would not like to speak for the work group. I will speak for my sort of perception. Of the three bills, and I will admit some confusion in keeping track of which bill is which, I think this one and the one that came out of the work group best reflect what we would like to see.
The league was not a member of the work group, so I can dig out. However, it frankly is my understanding that all three bills are being worked together in new work groups as they try to find a solution to the general concepts that are in all three, and that's what we're hoping, is that either using this as a vehicle or using House Bill 2081, that an agreement comes out from all of the parties and we can move something forward this session. That probably is the most critical thing for the League, is to see a solution, a beginning pilot. Let's get this moving so that we can begin to work this, because it's an important tool for our land use planning system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And we definitely will be relying on your expertise, since you served on the work group as the amendments come out.
That's why I asked about those two representatives, because they were much smarter in those hearings than I was.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
And the last three folks on the sign-up sheet, Mike Dewey, Randy Tucker, and Brock Howell.
I'm sure that's going to work.
Do
you want to use the...
I'm going to play duck, duck, goose after this.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, we'll make you go first.
Thank you. Mike Dewey, for the record, representing Stimson Lumber. I'll just be very brief. I know you have some other bills that are of interest to the people in the audience. Stimson, as a matter of background, is a family-owned timber company housed in Oregon, headquartered in Portland. They own and operate about 600,000 acres in the western United States. And notwithstanding the economy, Stimson wants to continue to be in the timber business. They also operate a number of mills. As you know, it's been very difficult this past 2 years for the industry. Nonetheless, they are interested in transfer development rights. And what I want to do is speak very briefly about the timber side of the equation as opposed to, if you will, the ag side. And I think this can be, on the timber side, much simpler than we sometimes want to make it. In a sense, I don't think you need to talk about credits per se, have credit banks. You have timber companies that own a lot of property in Oregon, and there is land that is arguably ready to be developed, and there might be a way to expedite that development. And in turn, and in lieu of kind of a quid pro quo, you have a situation where if you're able to do that, then you preserve some land somewhere else that you own. And it may be pristine land, and there would be a formula to do that. So you don't have credits. You basically have a formula by which you agree to develop this land over here. We have some property in Washington County that's very hard for us to, if you will, farm, have a adequate forest property because of the development in and around it. And if we are able to develop that, then we would agree to preserve some property in another location that ought to be preserved. And so we don't think this needs to be very difficult. We think there needs to be a formula. We've had some discussions with the director of the department to see how we might work this out. At the same time, if there's a bill that deals with a pilot, we'd like to figure out a way to at least have some language, and we've had this conversations in other rooms, so that there might be an opportunity to put that on the table. I know there are some people that are concerned about how significant we would move this. We don't have any problem with a pilot, but as I said, there is, I think, an opportunity to make this much more simpler on the timber side so that some of these companies can continue to operate in Oregon. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Randy, we'll go through everybody and then see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm a late pinch hitter for Dick Benner, who participated in the work group that developed various pieces of TDC legislation over the last several months and had planned to attend today. I'll just be very brief and say that Metro supports the legislation that's before you because it gives local governments in our region an additional tool to protect resources outside the urban growth boundary. We don't think we're affected by the parts of the bill that are still being negotiated, so we're comfortable with the language that is before you today. And I've distributed Dick's testimony for the record.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I am a land use advocate for Environment Oregon. There are several benefits to a TDC or TDR program that I think are essential to this. One is just protecting open space, but then also providing more livable, more dense and compact communities. And then also the benefit to farmers and to foresters of having the certainty of knowing what the existing land use pattern is going to be forever in the future through the conservation easement protection. And then also in the short term of the economic benefit of being able to get the tax benefit of through a conservation easement. So for those reasons, Environment Oregon is supportive of this bill. I would just like to make a couple of points of where our concern lies and just being mindful of the overall programs throughout our country. Most important is how we define our sending and receiving zones. Oregon is in a great position as far as having well-defined, well-structured sending and receiving zones because we do have a comprehensive land use system. of where we have very defined sending zones and very defined receiving zones. Other states that do not have this have problems in being able to have good sending and receiving zones, creating, in some instances, like the state of Maryland, where they didn't define where the receiving zone necessarily was to begin with, of where you may encourage development in a rural area where you hadn't wanted it. And so having a better definition of the receiving zone being the urban growth boundary and the land there within is, I think, the appropriate way. We do have some concerns about how we're using urban reserves and that we may be encouraging development outside of the urban growth boundary a little bit too soon and putting a little bit too much pressure on adjoining exclusive farm use land. So that raises a small concern, but as written, Environment Oregon is supportive of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. Anybody else would like to come up and testify on this bill, Senate Bill 763? Going once, going twice. The proponents of this bill, I just will caution you that, as you probably know, time is of the essence because we only have a couple weeks left working on Senate bills, so I know you're working on the amendment, and just encourage folks to get those in, looking over at Bob back there as quickly as possible. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 763. And committee members, I'm going to open up jointly a hearing on Senate Bill 742 and Senate Bill 320. And I'll tell you why in just a minute after I open those up. We have a lot of the same people who are going to be testifying on them. And I thought it would save the committee time. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 742 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 320. And Beth, if you can provide an overview for both, and then I'll say a few comments.
Senator Dingfelder and committee members, Senate Bill 742 finds that it's the best interest of the state for producers to finance and manage a statewide product stewardship system that provides free opportunities to collect, transport, recover, and manage lighting that contains mercury. Senate Bill 320 requires that retailers selling rechargeable batteries accept a certain quantity, post a sign, provide notice of an opportunity to return batteries purchased online, and have a suitable receptacle into which consumers may deposit their batteries. Requires that battery manufacturers or group of manufacturers are responsible for arranging for the return of batteries at their own expense.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And committee members, I'll just share with you, since one of these is a committee bill and the other one is my bill, how these came about. And I think many of you know, and I think almost all of you, except for Senator Hess, I don't think you were here last session, when we had the computer recycling bill, the e-waste bill before us. That is a bill, a process that I worked on for about 7 years, and these two bills that you see in front of you come out of that same sort of thought process of product stewardship, and you'll hear a little bit more about that. But there are many components of our waste stream that came up in discussion when we started talking about e-waste. Other areas of concern, two of them you'll hear today, one of them is batteries, and in particular, batteries that contain heavy metals. Second was fluorescent lights that contain mercury. And so both of these are being proposed under a product stewardship goal of planning for the recycling or disposable product at the end of its useful life. So Senate Bill 742 is the mercury-containing light bulb bill. That Senate Bill 320 is a rechargeable battery bill. And you're going to hear a little bit more specifics about both these bills, but the concern was that they both have toxic elements, that they're both recycled or handled properly, and based on the model that the e-waste bill was set forth and passed unanimously by this legislature last session. I will tell you that other states are working on legislation for both of these, so you'll hear a little bit more about that, and you'll hear more about the concerns, mainly with the fluorescent lights. There's not a lot of recycling opportunities right now. As I mentioned, they contain mercury. Rechargeable batteries contain heavy metals such as mercury, cadmium, and lead. And there are some recycling opportunities available. We're going to hear from the industry that couldn't be here, but I wanted to make sure that they had the opportunity. I'd ask them to be on a panel, the Rechargeable Battery Recycling Corporation, and they're going to call us from the East Coast, along with Wayne Reifer, who has worked on this issue actually nationwide. So with that, I'm going to call up the first panel that actually will speak on both these bills, Scott Clegg from Metro, Katie Daly with Recycling Advocates, and then Palmer Mason. If you can come up. I'm glad that you were able to make it, Katie. Katie is about to add two more constituents to my district. So we're glad that we snuck you in before the...
It's my last week.
Excitement.
Swan song.
Yes. So, Katie, do you want to start?
Actually, I think Scott is going to start.
Oh, you're
start.
I want to make a copy for you guys, but I think I would share that with you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Scott Clegg. I'm a senior planner with Metro's Resource Conservation and Recycling Department, and I'm here today to testify in support of both Senate Bills 320 and 742. Metro, as you may know, is the regional government in the Portland area. We're responsible for management of the solid waste in our area, and our responsibilities include coming up with a plan to manage solid waste, as well as providing coordination among recycling programs with the local governments, and an extensive and rather expensive household hazardous waste program, where we do take both rechargeable batteries and fluorescent lights. I'm here today to talk about 320, which will provide legislative support for product stewardship efforts really already underway that have been taken by the rechargeable battery industries, and also 742, which would set up a similar program for mercury-containing lights. We all know that rechargeable batteries are found in many more products these days that we have. We and our children constantly have these batteries in the power tools we have, cameras, music players. I kind of pride myself in having taught my children to use rechargeable batteries in their music players rather than go through all the alkaline. They also contain, but we do know that they need to be managed responsibly because they can contain heavy metals such as cadmium, and they also have valuable natural resources which can be recycled into new products, and also recycling them saves energy and you don't have to mine for some of the materials, the metals in particular. You avoid having to re-mine for those. Now, as I noted, the manufacturers have already established an organization, which Chair Dingfelder noted, and a program to steward rechargeable batteries. And while the industry is firmly committed to this program, they face several challenges. The first one is that many consumers really don't know where to take these. The industry's had a program for over a decade now, but we know that we're not, generally many of us know that we're not supposed to put these in the trash, but sometimes we just stick them in the drawer because we can't remember quite where it is we're supposed to take them to. So we need to do something about that. Second of all, while the industry really has engaged in a program to have their services offered at a large number of retail chain stores, Home Depot, Radio Shack, just their scores, and they'll be talking about that today, I'm sure. Sometimes we found that really the people that work in the stores and the individual level really aren't very savvy about the program, don't know where it is, aren't quite sure where the container is, even if it is in their store. And then thirdly, we know that there is an issue that not all the manufacturers that sell rechargeable batteries belong to this return program. This is called a free rider problem. They're taking advantage of the fact that some of the manufacturers have stepped up and provided these services. So that needs to be addressed. Now, we know we define product stewardship as a shared responsibility amongst those who make, sell, and use the product, and we would like to see legislation that address the problem of the current system and really just enable each party, the consumers, the retailers, and the manufacturers, made it easier to fulfill their responsibilities. And we think that while some parts of Senate Bill 320 need to be amended, the bill does have two important key elements that should be part of any stewardship legislation for rechargeable batteries. First, it does address the need that all manufacturers that sell into the state have to be part of a return program. This would address the free rider problem and level the playing field for manufacturers that are already paying into the system. This is very similar to what the provisions are for the new e-waste law that was talked about. Second of all, the legislation really needs to help increase the level of consumer participation in the programs. Metro has spent the last several years working on a number of programs where we're really trying to get a handle on what makes people use the recycling programs they have. And what we find is that really getting in, touching, getting contact with the consumer, understanding what really makes them understand where a program, how a program works, really that point of contact with the individual. In, for example, our curbside recycling programs, we found that in order to keep glass out of the bin so it doesn't contaminate paper that goes to the paper mills, really requires you to look at the bin each time, or at least on a random basis, and put a note to the note to the household that you know, really should put the glass on the side. Also, our other programs on transit demand, managing transit options, and that we look at that, trying to get really to educate and talk to the person directly is the effective technique. So we think that the provisions in a bill needs to have the retailers provide some notification and information to the customer about where they can take their batteries. Regarding the fluorescent light bill, mercury-containing lighting bill, Metro believes that the time for a stewardship requirement for mercury lighting has arrived. We get quite a number of calls at our recycling hotline for these, more as time goes on, as these start to burn out. We have a limited number of places we can send people now. We do, as I said, take these programs at our household hazardous waste facilities and events, but with the number that are out there and the convenience that the consumer requires, we just don't see that we're going to be able to provide the collection system that's necessary to manage all the lamps as the years go on. They're going to be coming in. And we think the provisions as written in Senate Bill 742 are very reasonable in terms of what the burden it's put on the manufacturers and such. Now, we spend in the metro area over $5 million a year to provide our household hazardous waste programs. We feel like we're doing our share at the government level. We would continue to promote the education through our education programs, these stewardship programs of these manufacturers. And we've seen that from the early information coming back on the eCycles program, that having these expanded collection opportunities has really been a very effective way to get consumers to come in. Just having our two permanent facilities in the region and a couple collection events scattered throughout the year doesn't provide the services necessary, particularly for these two products. So we urge you to make Oregon a continued leader in this area and urge your support for both these bills. Thank you.
Thank you. And Scott, if you could follow up at the email with the amount of batteries and fluorescent lights that you're collecting now at your transfer stations, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Annually,
okay.
Just to get a sense, because you're one of the, probably the largest programs in the in the state. Okay. Who wants to go next? Hummer? Oh, great.
So before I get started,
you're going to have to move the mic towards you.
And introduce myself. Yeah. Yes. Palmer Mason, Department of Environmental Quality. Before I get started, there are three documents that I think the staff is passing out to you. One is a hard copy of the slide presentation, and then the second is a one-pager both on rechargeable batteries and mercury lighting. It's a front and back document. And then the other thing is a chart, also front and back, that shows you which states have either active or pending legislation on a variety of product stewardship type products that have gone through product stewardship. So with that, we'll start the... Okay, and bear with me also. Some of this information may be overlap what Scott said, and I'll try to hurry through that. Why are we concerned about mercury-containing lights? I think pretty much everyone now who's followed these hearings know that we've got lights out there with mercury in it. Mercury is a powerful neurotoxin, and you see some amounts there listed with each of these type of lights. I'll add, too, that methyl mercury is particularly harmful and occurs quite frequently as a result of the decomposition process in a landfill. That particular anaerobic environment accelerates the conversion to methyl mercury. When mercury is released into the environment, it's a problem. You see here with a high number of bulbs being broken by the time they reach the landfill. Mercury lights, and this shouldn't be any surprise to anybody, are growing part of the waste stream. We want people to move from the incandescent bulbs that they have now over to compact fluorescent light bulbs, so that's good. The problem that we have here in Oregon is that small businesses and households who want to do that really don't have a good alternative to safely dispose of those CFLs. There aren't many collection sites around the state to do that. And you see some growth figures there for fluorescent lamps. Scott also pointed this out, but it's worth repeating that most of the materials from a light can be recycled. And you see the basic problem here is that we have a fairly high percentage of the commercial lights being recycled, but on the residential side, the small business side, very few of the lights are actually recycled. And you see also that quite a few lights are disposed of here in Oregon. How do lights get handled? How do these mercury-containing lights get handled? There's limited options here. One is to toss in the trash, which is something that we certainly want to discourage. But the reason they do get tossed in the trash is because there's only a limited hazardous waste collection system, household hazardous waste collection system in this state, and you see some facts to that. We only have 8 counties that have a permanent facility. Another option is to bring it to a local government like Metro or a county that would have a collection event, but the problem with these collection events is they're rather periodic. There's about 14 counties that don't even do them at all. And even when a county provides or another local government provides a collection event, it's not always in a convenient location for people to drop off their lights. We should note and recognize, though, that some of the retailers out there are stepping up, in particular Home Depot and IKEA, and taking back discarded lights from their customers. Large business generators have a better process in which to handle mercury lights. They can take them to a hazardous waste disposal facility. There are other light recycling facilities in Oregon, and some of these recycling facilities both in Oregon and throughout the country offer mail take back for large business generators. And before I go on batteries, I did want to note that there are about 7 states with pending or active legislation on mercury lighting. That's not something that was in the slide here. Why are we concerned about rechargeable batteries? Scott pointed out some of the reasons for that, some of the various metals and toxins that are in batteries. It should be noted, though, that rechargeable batteries are a lot less toxic and batteries as a whole than they used to be. That's something that we have to acknowledge the battery industry for doing, but they can still be a significant amount of some of the toxics, heavy metals, in landfills. We also, you just heard testimony about the fact that rechargeable batteries is a growing. I think we all know and use products that are use those type of rechargeable batteries, and that's grown substantially here over the last few years from an average of 3 per person to 6. Again, batteries are like mercury-containing lights. There's valuable material that can be recovered. It probably should be recovered. And recycling saves us energy and reduces the need for virgin materials. And what's happening with rechargeable batteries in Oregon? We don't have Oregon-specific information, but this is a national statistic here that 61% of Americans are throwing their unwanted batteries in the trash or being forced to stockpile them at home. It was mentioned that the battery manufacturers have stepped forward with a voluntary effort, the Rechargeable Battery Recycling Corporation. It's operated since 1996. And they do have quite an extensive infrastructure, both here in Oregon and nationally, that with additional promotion and some other things could be quite effective. And as it is, it works very well, and it's probably one of the best industry approaches on product stewardship out there. Just want to mention some of the collection sites that you can go to and use the manufacturer's system here. And here's some statistics on what they have recovered between the years of 2003 and 2008 in the way of rechargeable batteries. Just do a couple of quick slides on product stewardship since it's a concept that we spend a lot of time talking about. The idea here is that you involve those who produce, distribute, and use a product in its end-of-life management. So we would take the manufacturers, the distributors, and the consumers and involve all of them in dealing with the discarded products once the product's been used up. One of the reasons why a number of these bills focus a great deal on the producers of the product is because the producers in the best position, given what they do, to control the design and manufacture of the product. And one last piece is that producers are generally required to finance and manage systems for the collection and recycling or safe disposal of a discarded product in a way that is convenient to the consumer. And I think it's that last part that's in really needs to be stressed about why, in particular, the department is interested in the various product stewardship bills, is that our current system for household hazardous waste is so limited, and we're looking for creating greater opportunities, more convenient opportunities for people to recycle discarded products. You've heard testimony about some of the environmental benefits of product stewardship approaches, so I won't go into them in great detail. But I did want to emphasize or point out the second bullet here about distributing the cost of waste management more equitably. Right now, under our current system, waste management is largely a local government ratepayer, taxpayer responsibility. This approach would shift that back to the producers and users of products to take on more of the waste management cost of the products that they produce and use. And one of the ideas behind that is now you're making producers responsible for that waste management, and as a result, they now have to internalize the cost of doing so, and that gives them a cost incentive they haven't had before to look at how to reduce the environmental impacts of their products and make their products less wasteful. And then finally, producers have flexibility to operate programs. We saw, in the case of Oregon's e-waste law, quite a bit of creativity about how to provide a convenient collection and recycling system here in Oregon, and the same thing can happen for other products. So I think with that, I'm finished.
Thank you, Palmer. Katie?
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Daly, and today I'm testifying on behalf of the grassroots organization Recycling Advocates, for which I'm the board chair. I handed out testimony regarding Senate Bill 742. A lot of that testimony was already presented by the previous two panelists. And I don't have written testimony for Senate Bill 320. Wayne Reifer, who's going to be on the phone, I believe, a little bit later, who is also a member of Recycling Advocates, but he's speaking on behalf of himself, will probably cover a lot of the details that I would be covering as well. But so I just want to speak generally on behalf of these two bills. I think the two products that are in these two bills, mercury-containing lamps and rechargeable batteries, are in different places with respect to the need for product stewardship, and I think it's useful to point that out. Generally, Recycling Advocates really supports the product stewardship model, and as these guys were talking about, you know, the management, the end-of-life management for our products on those who design, produce, sell, or use products in order to minimize the product's environmental impact throughout all stages of the product's life cycle is a very important foundation of product stewardship. And Oregon has a good history now of implementing product stewardship models. The e-waste is a perfect example, and I think it should set the tone for moving forward with some of these hard-to-manage products. With respect to mercury-containing lamps, you know, we've had the fluorescent tube lights for a long time, and a lot of people have them in their garages, have them in their basements. They're not going anywhere, and they're going to be they're good because they last a long time, but people have faced for a long time what to do with them at the end of life, and we really don't have good programs for it. But on top of that, obviously, there has been a big push by utilities, by Energy Trust, by environmental organizations, by the state to get consumers to use compact fluorescent lights, and it's great that that growth has happened, and it's something that we should be doing as a society in order to decrease our energy use. But because of their long life cycle, and they last up to 10 times longer than incandescent lights, we're really at the beginning of the wave of a need of for disposal for a lot of these. And I think it's going to be a big problem that's just going to get bigger and bigger as the years go on. At the same time, the industry has done a good job of trying to get less get the mercury more and more out of the products. And there's talk that in, 10, 15 years, they will be replaced economically. They'll be feasible to replace them with LEDs and other types of lights. But they're still, because of their long life cycle, going to be in the in use for a long time and in the waste stream for a long time. So right now is a very, very ripe time for something for mercury-containing lamps. It's becoming a bigger, bigger burden on our local governments. Outside of the metro area, there really aren't that many places to bring your mercury-containing lamps. And, Senator Walker was just, I think, telling Senator Dingfelder a little while ago, she doesn't even buy CFLs because of the problems with what to do with them at the end of their life. And I think that's a big problem that we need to overcome. And it's incumbent upon the manufacturers to be part of the solution of that problem. With respect to batteries, as these guys both pointed out, we have more and more products that are going to be containing rechargeable batteries, as we should. I mean, that's the model that we should be moving to. But this problem isn't going to be going away. It's just going to be getting bigger and bigger, as with e-waste. And so setting up a program now to be able to address, a lot of different future needs is pretty critical as well. So, and with respect to batteries, the RBRC has an excellent program already in place, but these guys mentioned the problems that they have with actually getting consumers familiar with the return places. I think they cited 600 or 800 statewide. So there already is the collection system in place. There just needs to be a little more structure to make sure that consumers have the information that they need and know to bring where they need to bring things back. And as they said, to make sure that everybody who produces rechargeable batteries is responsible and not just those that are responsible part of RBRC. So to make sure that we distribute the responsibility among all the responsible parties. So those are the things that I mostly wanted to bring up. I think the biggest issue is the convenience factor and making sure that all Oregonians have access to the same amount of convenience, and it isn't just limited to people who happen to live close to places where they happen to have more programs. That was the key to the e-waste bill. I think that's the key to any product stewardship bill. Oregon can be a leader, and I think it's exciting that we're considering this. We were not the first state to adopt e-waste, but we were pretty quickly coming on the heels of Washington, and I think we can be a leader on these two products and set the stage for hopefully national programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? No? I actually have a question. Whoever wants to answer this, it might be for Palmer, because this is the sheet that you handed out. And for folks in the audience, it says U.S. Product Stewardship Laws and Legislation, dated March 2009. And it lists all the different states and what programs have been adopted. So, it's quite an array. Some have e-waste bills, some have fluorescent lights, some have batteries. Have you talked to the other states? Obviously, I know you've been working on the e-waste implementation of the e-waste bill for quite a while, but have you talked to the other states that have battery laws? And I noticed some of them were signed into law quite a few years ago. And are they dealing now with more disposable batteries versus rechargeable?
Yeah. Batteries. Chairman Dingfelder, yes, the answer is those older laws dealt more with the alkaline and disposable batteries, and then there have been states who have adopted more recent legislation dealing with rechargeable batteries. I don't know that I can give you an exact breakdown of which states fall into which camp, but you do see quite a bit of, I think it's either 12 to 15, and I don't know that this chart has it all, but mm-hmm. I think there's at least 12, maybe 15 states that have some type of battery legislation.
Already.
That's a product stewardship type, or it may be a take-back type model.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I can follow up on that, Palmer, looking at the list, I'd highlighted the ones that are signed in law, and then looking at rechargeable batteries, Maryland has one that looks like it's been on the books since 93, as compared to California in 2006. And so your chart actually breaks out the different type of batteries pretty good.
So it's about a dozen states that have adopted battery
legislation. I think it's around about a dozen total. I just didn't know off the top of my head which were the breakdown for which.
Well, and I will mention to the committee members and members of the audience that when we worked on the e-waste bill, one of the things that I heard again and again from citizens, from Oregon residents, they said, why doesn't this bill include rechargeable batteries? Because, yes, I can take my computer, but what do I do with the rechargeable battery afterwards? And so, unfortunately, that was not part of that bill, and that's one of the reasons I did bring this bill forward, because they heard probably on that issue more than any other issue, first on batteries, second on fluorescent lights, about where I can take them and why can't we recycle them as part of that bill. So appreciate the work you've done on this, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you more. And we have many other folks coming up, so there may be questions that I might ask you, Palmer, to come back. Part of this panel was Wayne Reifer, who is on the phone. I'd asked him to be part of the panel and had to be back in D.C., so he's on the phone. And then we will hear from David Weinberg right after him, and then we'll start calling through the list. Did you lose him?
We lost him.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to get Wayne Reifer on the phone, who has worked actually on the computer recycling bill with me, and has been very involved with the battery recycling works for the Green Electronics Council. So hopefully we can get him back on, and then we'll get the Battery Recycling Corporation on, and then we'll call up our list. I will mention that if you signed up on both for both bills, to testify on both bills, I'm going to ask you to come up and provide testimony on both to save time instead of calling up on one and then on the other. So we have quite a few people who signed up for both bills. So just if you could be prepared to give statements on both, since we have public hearing that's already open. And if we can't get them right back, we'll just start down the list. Okay, it's going into voicemail. So why don't we try, since they're waiting, I know that David's back east and he's waiting and it's 3 hours later there. We'll try David Weinberg in the meantime. We'll try to get Wayne back on. And just so folks know, I'm just going to go down the list in the order. So I will next call up after the phone calls Peggy Lynch, Sean Miller, and Andy Sloop, so you guys can be on board. And you do have their written testimony in your packet for both of the folks who I've asked to be available. Can you get either? Okay. Hello, David?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, you're really loud. We'll turn you down here just a minute. Hi, this is Senator Dingfelder, and you are now on speakerphone in front of the Oregon Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee hearing on both the battery legislation and the fluorescent light, but I know that you're only speaking on behalf of the battery legislation.
Yes. Well, thank you, Senator, and I very much appreciate, and my family very much appreciates your accommodating our schedule this week with the holidays. And I must say, sitting here in Washington and watching you on the Internet, I need to compliment the Oregon legislature. You have a very efficient system. It's very impressive.
Thank you. And can you state your name for the record?
My name is David Weinberg, and I am the general counsel of both the Portable Rechargeable Battery Association and the Rechargeable Battery Recycling Corporation. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of both organizations in support of SB 320. I believe you have a copy of an extensive prepared statement,
yes,
which I will not read.
Thank you.
In total. I just want to touch on some of the high points and then be very happy to answer any questions you may have. The rechargeable battery industry has been a leader in the product stewardship area. The Trade Association has been in business for approximately 20 years. RBRC, the company which actually operates the rechargeable battery program, has been doing that since 1996. We were the folks that urged EPA to adopt the so-called universal waste rule, which makes recycling programs or potentially hazardous materials possible, and ultimately actually convinced the Congress to enact a statute so that we could implement the RBRC program in 1996 nationwide. you have in your, you were just talking a few moments ago, I think, about some other states. On the second page of my prepared testimony, there's actually a summary of the state laws that were passed in other states. Most of them were passed in the early 90s. There have been only two enacted since the RBRC has been operating, and I'm happy to say that both of those in New York and in New York City and in California expressly recognize RBRC as an appropriate mechanism with which to meet the stewardship mandate that those jurisdictions adopted. In the materials that we have provided you, there are a couple of charts that summarize, beginning on the sixth page, the activities in Oregon in particular RBRC has performed. The RBRC Call to Recycle program operates nationally. It operates on a budget of approximately $10 million a year. Since it's been operating, it has recycled more than 50 million pounds of rechargeable batteries at no cost to consumers. The entire cost of the program is paid for by the manufacturers of rechargeable batteries and rechargeable battery products. They do that through licensing the display of a seal, something analogous to the Good Housekeeping seal. There are about 350 companies who currently are supporting us, and we operate both retail locations, or support both retail locations and industrial and commercial locations. As the slides indicate that you have on page 6 of the prepared testimony, RBRC operates 800 active sites in Oregon at this point, and I might be very clear about that. Those are sites which have shipped batteries back for recycling in the last 18 months. There are 800 such locations. Many of them are major retailers. In addition, there are we get batteries back from some of the state and local environmental agencies and various institutions. The company received about 70,000 pounds, actually a little bit more, from Oregon in 2008, and is working hard with several of the people who have testified before you this morning to continue to increase that number. Towards the end of the testimony, I think is probably the most important perspective in terms of what you are dealing with today, that is our views on the bill in particular. As the prepared testimony indicates, we believe that the approach that's reflected in SB 320 is the best approach for government to take in encouraging battery stewardship. It provides essentially for a program quite similar to the RBRC program, and we find that provisions in there are generally attractive. There are a number of, I think, relatively minor changes that we have suggested. Most important of those, I think, are the several bullet points that appear on page 9 of the testimony. First, there is not any mercury in rechargeable batteries. That has been historically an issue with non-rechargeable batteries, although it's now been taken out of almost all the non-rechargeable batteries as well. So there needs to be a correction in the reference there. We suggested that the battery definition, the rechargeable battery definition, be made consistent with the Federal Battery Act. We urge a simplification of the reporting requirements and no need for annual reports unless there are changes, no need for annual plan filing unless there are changes. There would be annual reports on collections. We very much would appreciate it if the legislature in Oregon took the same view that the legislature in California took and the New York City Council took and expressly recognized that participation in the RBRC program meets the requirements of the state legislation. It doesn't mean that's the only way people could meet it, but needless to say, that does encourage the few remaining hangers-on who have not been supporting this program to do so, and we find that attractive. We have a suggestion on the easily removable language to correct that language so that products like very small Bluetooth headsets and the like not have to have easily removable batteries, when that would actually make the product bigger and the batteries are quite small. And it may well be that there are other changes that are appropriate for the easily removable provision of the law that would make sense in light of other products, but I'll leave that for others to testify about. But as a general matter, we strongly support the bill. We commend the legislature and Senator Dingfelder in particular for moving forward in this important area, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you or other senators might have.
Okay, thank you very much. We really appreciate you calling in. I know it's off. It's terribly late there, David, so
right. We
apologize for calling you late. You guys are, 3 hours ahead, right?
Yeah, my pleasure, though.
Yes.
So you're
probably having dinner or dessert at this point. I do have some questions, and I'm going to see if my committee has questions before I do. Yeah, okay. Thank you, and I also want to thank you for your organization's leadership on this, because I know you've been doing this for a long time. You're probably one of the longest programs that I know of going on, and the fact that you actually had the manufacturers come forward on a voluntary basis is really helpful, and I think sets a good example for product stewardship. A couple of questions that I have is regarding how are manufacturers or the retailers that are involved in this program, how did it get the word out to consumers?
Very good question, Senator, and I'm pleased to respond. There are several different things that are done. First of all, RBRC provides all of its retail partners with a wide variety of what are referred to in the trade as collateral materials, signage and the like. We also provide matte materials for inclusion in publications and ads and so forth. Second, RBRC itself provides public service announcements both on television and on radio. They tend to run more heavily during the holiday season because obviously that's when people are thinking most heavily about these kinds of issues. And third, we also run paid advertising in appropriate media. Some of those are large-scale media, such as National Geographic, where we know the audience are people who are inclined to be positive about this, but need to know more about these things. And some of that advertising is much more narrowly targeted on particular jurisdictions and in particular local newspapers and the like.
Okay, thank you. And then you had mentioned that there's about 800 locations already in Oregon that are available to residents. So how do you see, and I appreciate your support of the bill, how do you see this bill helping your program? And, you know, I guess the question would be, do you think this bill is necessary? Could this help get a greater percentage, capture a greater percentage of the waste stream that isn't currently being captured?
Well, I think it probably will help if it expands the advertising and the community knowledge, as several of your previous speakers have indicated. We do have in this area already very widespread participation on the part of the industry supporters. And there are not very many players who are not supporting the organization, but that's in large part because there have been other states that have adopted or other jurisdictions that have adopted mandatory legislation. And some of the companies that otherwise hadn't volunteered to join as early have come along since. Additional states imposing requirements is just an additional encouragement for anyone who is still not supporting the RBRC program. And as a couple of your prior witnesses have testified, it's anything that will get further word out to consumers is always going to be useful in improving collection rates.
Okay. And my final question is, I just want to clarify, if retailers participate in your program, my understanding, and I want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, is they're, all of their costs for collection and advertising are covered by your association?
Yes, what RBRC does is provide them retailers with a collection box and the so-called collateral materials I described. The collection box itself is a shipping box. When it's full, the box gets closed, and they can call a shipping company, which picks it up at RBRC's expense and takes it to a recycling location. The only expense that the retailer faces is the space where he or she puts the box. And if he or she can make use of the materials that RBRC has given them to help in their local advertising.
Okay. All right, thank you. I really appreciate your knowledge and extensive experience with this. I am going to ask if you could follow up one piece of information that I think would be helpful for the committee, which is a companion to Figure 1, which shows the active collection sites from 2003 to 2008, is if you have a map, I mean, geographically, I think it would be helpful to see where these sites are, where the coverage is statewide. Because one of the issues that came up with when we talked about implementation of the e-waste bill, and we actually put it in the bill, is a requirement to cover all counties in the state, and in particular, making sure that there was access in rural areas.
We'll be happy to do that. I might add, however, by way of helping you out on that, if you go to the RBRC website, www.rbrc.com, mm-hmm. You can put in, there's a mechanism there where you can put in a zip code, and it will tell you what the closest location is for you.
Okay.
We will also get you the map, Senator, that you suggested would be helpful.
That would be really helpful. Appreciate it. Before we let David go, any other last-minute questions? Okay. Thank you very much, David, and I, again, appreciate you taking time out of your schedule and out of your evening with your family.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Senator, and we thank the committee as a whole.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Now we have Wayne Reifer. And then we'll go down to the folks who have signed up. Wayne?
Oh, yes, Senator Dingfelder.
Hi, this is Senator Dingfelder in the committee, and you're on speakerphone now.
And you can hear me okay?
Yes. So don't say anything you don't want to have in public record.
Very good. Members of the committee, thank you very much for taking my testimony, and I'm so sorry that I cannot be there with you, but I'm on the East Coast now. I am Wayne Reifer. I reside at 1975 Northwest 113th in Portland. Do you have
yes.
a written testimony?
We do.
For you there?
We do, Wayne. Thank you. So if you can summarize it, because we do have that, that would be great.
I will be happy to. You can see from the introductory paragraph that I'm very involved with the electronics industry. I am a board member of RBRC, and of course work very closely with David Weinberger. And I had the great pleasure of working with Senator Dingfelder on the e-waste legislation over 3 legislative sessions. But I speak to you here today really as an Oregon citizen speaking for myself. I really believe very strongly that product stewardship is a very strong way to go, and in particular, the principle of shared responsibility. And this is the shared responsibility idea is really especially important for rechargeable batteries. Rechargeable batteries are small, and it really requires a strong dedication of education to the consumer in order to have an effective recycling program. RBRC is really dedicated to its recycling program and nationwide system. I've been very pleased to have been working with them over the last 3 years. In helping that program. RBRC makes recycling free and easy for consumers, and it makes it free and easy for retailers to offer the recycling service to their customers, and I think that's a tremendous program. But RBRC cannot do the job alone. These products, rechargeable batteries, are just too small, too easily discarded, too easily overlooked. And they just are not making it into the recycling system at the rate that they should be. And they should be recycled in part because some of them have toxic materials in them, but they all have valuable resources that should be recycled. So it's so important to get the message out to consumers. That is a shared effort that must be done by, first of all, everybody who is in the chain of commerce. But also government has a very important role to play, both in terms of
the activities that you were considering, as well as local governments in terms of reaching out to their local citizens. Frankly, RBRC's recycling rate is not nearly as high as it should be, or as it could be with the proper program that really is implemented through a shared responsibility program. That's the whole purpose of this legislation, in my mind, is really to do that and to help citizens to take that responsibility, which they are, in fact, ready and willing to do so. RBRC has done some surveys, and they have found, interestingly enough, that by and large, rechargeable batteries are not being disposed of by consumers. That is to say, the ones that they're not recycling are not also going into the garbage. Now, some are, of course, but a lot are not. And you know where they're going? They're going away in drawers. You know, I do. I put them away in drawers because somehow I know that these items are really little bundles of chemicals and they really shouldn't go into the garbage. But I also, at least until I started working with RBRC, I really didn't know what to do with them either. Well, RBRC does provide that option for consumers, and the whole idea of this legislation is to get the word out so that people will know better what to do, do with those products. I want to highlight three key points. First is the important role that retailers play in communicating to the public. I would note that the Recycling Advocates, that's an organization I'm on the board of, we did a very small survey, a very small study of how RBRC's program is being promoted in retail stores. And, the results really were not terribly encouraging, and you can see some of the statistics that came out of that study. Now, none of the stores that we surveyed, not a large sample, needs to be larger, but for our limited resources, it's what we could do. No stores had visible signage. 60% of the stores had no indication when you did, you know, a walkthrough, your initial walkthrough the store, didn't see it. And so on with the statistics there. So the whole idea of this legislation is to help get that word out more directly, more effectively. Now, I will note, it's changing. Best Buy, for example, my local Best Buy, indeed, at the front entrance to the store as you walk in, there's a little recycling center for rechargeable batteries and cell phones and other things like that. So retailers are willing to do it, and they're finding increasingly it's a way to get business into their store. It's a service their customers appreciate. Secondly, and I don't believe that David mentioned this, at least as far as I could hear, but RBRC does need some help with certain reluctant manufacturers as far as joining in on the RBRC program. There are some free riders. That is, say, companies that make or package in their products are rechargeable batteries who are not a part of RBRC, and they probably should be because they're free riding on the system that's paid for by the other companies. But then lastly, just let me reemphasize the shared responsibility aspect and how this program would really complement the computers and the television recycling that is being sponsored by the e-waste bill, Senator Dingfelder, from last session, and how important it is to get a good, consistent system out there for the public. Thank you very much
Great.
For taking my comments.
Thank you, Wayne. Appreciate it. Are there any questions for Wayne, Mr. Reifer? Okay. Thank you, Wayne. We'll see you when you get back to Oregon. Travel safely.
Thank you, Trevor.
And just a reminder, you do have his written testimony here. Okay, so next up, we have Peggy Lynch, Sean Miller, and Andy Sloop. And can you please state which bill you're testifying on? And it could be one or the other or both. And I will hand the gavel off here just for a minute.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Specifically, we are testifying on both Senate Bill 320 and Senate Bill 742. The League supports policies to reduce the generation and promote the reuse and recycling of solid and hazardous waste. A product stewardship system for Oregon is in the best interests of the state as it encourages resource efficiency and reduces greenhouse gas emissions. We specifically support programs to address rechargeable batteries, and we commend RBRC for its support. And lighting that contains mercury in any program, products which are increasing in consumption in Oregon and offer significant risk to the health of Oregonians. And I'm going to say that one a second time. And offer significant risk to the health of Oregonians, just as you earlier addressed Senate Bill 739 and the arsenic issue. So we encourage your support of these two bills, and we are looking forward to seeing them passed by this legislative session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Whoever wants to go next.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 742. My name is Andy Sloop. I am the Oregon manager for Ecolites Northwest and Total Reclaim. Ecolites is the largest recycler of mercury-bearing lamps in the Pacific Northwest. Total Reclaim, the parent company of Ecolites, recycles covered electronic devices under the producer responsibility laws that took effect this year in both Oregon and Washington. Ecolites began recycling lamps 12 years ago before most people were aware that lamps contain mercury. We collect all types of lamps from all types of waste generators throughout the Pacific Northwest and recycle them at our lamp processing facility in Seattle. We currently recycle approximately 3 million lamps per year, including bulbs from state office buildings here in Salem. We also have mailback service and are active in retail and energy utility take-back programs in both Oregon and Washington. We work with retailers like IKEA, Ace Hardware, A-Boy up in the Seattle area, Seattle City Light, Puget Sound Energy, and others. Ecolites is a member of the Association of Lighting and Mercury Recyclers, ALMR. After I provide my comments on behalf of Ecolites, I'll submit written testimony on behalf of ALMR, which is a national nonprofit trade organization representing members of the mercury recycling industry. Ecolites supports recycling all mercury-bearing lamps from all types of waste generators. Our commitment to lamp recycling is clear. However, we do have some concerns about this bill as a small business. We have three primary concerns. SB 742 imposes requirements on manufacturers that would result in manufacturer control of a competitive industry and be disruptive to the existing lamp recycling ecosystem that we operate in. SB 742 requires producers of lighting that contains mercury to establish a product stewardship program, and the definition of product stewardship program that's in the bill is very far-reaching. It puts virtually all the responsibility on one stakeholder group who does not necessarily have the complete ability to fulfill its obligation under the bill. It also makes product stewardship programs in effect into super consumers that have a great deal of market power, and at risk undermining the existing systems that are keeping mercury out of the environment cost-effectively already. Our second concern is that the premise of this bill is that product stewardship for electronics is successful, so it should be replicated for lamps. The reality is that lamps are not entirely like electronics, and cloning the electronics law may have unintended side effects for lamp recycling, we believe. The most relevant difference between electronics and lamps is that lamps are regulated waste under federal law and electronics aren't. This raises questions in our mind and some uncertainty about potentially overlapping and conflicting liability and compliance under the existing waste lamp regulations. And our third concern is that the bill would create a split system, as the e-waste bill has, with covered and non-covered entities. Based on our experience with the electronics product stewardship, a split system is very difficult to administer. Everyone wants the free service. And while accepting a certain quantity of bulbs under the free system is an objective way to limit access to it, the system can be easily gamed. One example from Washington is that under the product stewardship system up there, the University of Washington used to send us all of their electronics under the existing commercial system. After the free system came in, some of their electronics wound up being sent to us via goodwill under the free system. University of Washington is not a covered entity, but some of their stuff is finding its way into the free system. Thus, the actual scope of the product stewardship system is much bigger than intended, and this is undermining the existing commercial recycling market at the expense of recyclers. We expect this would also happen under a product stewardship system for lamps. This is an important point because commercial generators account for the vast majority of mercury-bearing lamps that are generated, and the existing commercial market is sustainable without producer financing. We already have a robust, competitive, and efficient free market system that uses the existing infrastructure. There's substantial lamp recycling capacity in place today, and our company is actively investing in additional infrastructure. In fact, just this morning, we signed loan documents to invest $500,000 more in our lamp recycling operation. We're concerned about major changes to the existing business ecosystem that we operate in. What's lacking, in our view, is convenient collection and awareness about why and how to recycle lamps. We recommend a more incremental approach that leverages the existing infrastructure and does not risk undermining the existing system for recycling lamps from commercial generators. Specifically, we do support a landfill ban to encourage recovery of lamps from all types of generators. The highest lamp recovery levels in the country, in Minnesota and the Puget Sound area, are areas where there are disposal bans. We also support requiring retailers to provide information about why and how to recycle lamps. We believe this approach will increase lamp recycling from households significantly and that additional incremental steps can be taken if needed. Thank you.
Thanks. Andy, I have a quick question for you, and I appreciate your testimony, and I know you sat through all the months and months of committees on the e-waste. I have a question about your, in your conclusions and recommendations about landfill ban, and I'm sure you remember that discussion. One of the things we talked about was not having a landfill ban in place for e-waste until we had a system, a readily available system in which to collect the product. But I'm hearing the opposite here.
Well, what we found in Washington is that there's not a producer responsibility system up there for lamps, and there are a lot of collection sites. They have the Take It Back network that the counties have organized in collaboration with private entities. And I think what some of the collectors up there have realized is that there's opportunity for them. There have been some creative collaborative relationships that have emerged in the presence of that disposal ban up there, utilities working with retailers and recyclers and the local governments and so forth. And so it's happened sort of organically.
Okay. Yeah, the one thing I'm concerned about is telling people they can't throw it away and then not having readily available places throughout the state, you know.
Understood.
Obviously.
I mean, we don't have all the answers. We struggle with whether to testify today and mostly wanted to just express some concerns about the impact that this would have on our business. We think this could have on our business.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. Sean.
Thank you.
Oh, do you have a question for Andy specifically?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
I appreciate what you're saying here and your attempt to get at this, but if the DEQ says that 6 million these lights are disposed annually, then where does that put you in terms of getting at that group? I mean, where are you in terms of what's the perspective there?
Right. I mean, frankly, this represents both an opportunity and a threat for us as a business. It's a little bit like, you know, I can't think of a perfect analogy, but it's maybe a little bit like living next to a volcano, and you don't know if its eruption is going to create more fertile farmland for you or wipe out your village.
That's the type of logic we'd like around this building, actually.
Hawaii.
Yeah, right. Like that.
I'm
follow up.
Yes. It is a little bit self-serving for you to make these claims, though, right? That you're either against this or for it, based upon how it would affect your organization.
We're just expressing our perspective as one stakeholder among many. We recognize that we have typically been very aligned with the environmental community. We certainly, I mean, as I said, our commitment to recycling is very, very clear. We're very dedicated. We've invested millions. Frankly, producer responsibility may be good for recycling and not necessarily for recyclers.
And that's, you know, this has come up with the bottle belt as well, Madam Chair, is that, you know, what's good for Oregon may not necessarily be great for recyclers. And, we'd love this problem to go away and you could have a fertile farm with volcanic ash or whatever, however you want to.
You're going to be living down that analogy for a long time. All right. Thank you. We appreciate your response to that. Sean.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today representing the National Electrical Manufacturers Association Lighting Division, which comprises of companies including GE Lighting, Philips, and Sylvania, many of the companies that actually produce the energy-efficient lighting, much as what you see in the Capitol building and above you.
I just want to remind folks, if we have your written testimony, please do not read it, and we'll ask you to just highlight key points.
I'm not going
so
to
So my
read
committee
it.
Won't mutiny me. We end up being here not too long.
Madam Chair, and I will not read that testimony. I wanted to let you know that Mark Kohorst just handed out his written testimony from NEMA, and he could not be here today, but I will just a couple points from that testimony. You know, we're opposing Senate Bill 742 because we believe, you know, there is some problems with a system on what the current manufacturers are doing currently today. And although I think a lot could be done to improve that system, especially on the residential side, one of the problems that we've encountered is it does not distinguish between lamps generated for the residential sector versus the business sector. And you know, the latter is served by recycling companies, and although we can do a better job there, I think the bill doesn't distinguish between the two. One of the points I also want to make is that this will increase the cost of the energy-efficient lighting, in which will conflict with the energy efficiency goals I know that this committee and the legislature has been making. It will drive up the cost of that particular product, which produces less people using that product. And so if we're trying to incentivize, you know, that's a point that I know has been made in other states. In that regard, in contrary to that chart I know that was passed out, no state has actually adopted a product stewardship model on lamps. And so although I know that chart references a lot of states that actually are considering it, no state has adopted that. And the only last thing I'd want to say is there's a website called recycleabulb.com, which you can go ahead and punch your zip code into, and you can see different sites. I did the Capitol building here. There is three sites, two Home Depots and the Salem-Keizer transfer station within 5 miles that you can recycle your mercury lamps. And so, you know, stores like Home Depot, True Value, other hardware stores are increasing that, as well as the manufacturers are working to improve the product. I will state one of the things that the DEQ did mention on that they believe the product stewardship improves the product design. I don't believe that to be true at all. And the industry over since the 1990s has actually reduced the level of mercury in these products just a fraction of what it was in the 90s, and actually you're going to see other technology of the LEDs and halogen lamps in the near future, in the next decade, which will actually transform, I think, into the next product. And so this is all absent a product stewardship program. So the manufacturers are moving there. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? I will make a comment, and I know this is not your testimony, but this gentleman from Virginia, on the page 4, I guess it's about the third paragraph from the bottom, about recycling costs, I'll read it, ultimately must be borne by some party and allocated somehow. I think that's a pretty profound statement. A system that lays the entire burden on manufacturers is the highest cost, least efficient option this committee has available to it. There is absolutely no model anywhere in the country for this approach. Well, that's not true because we passed the e-waste bill here last session with the manufacturers are paying for that system. However, we look at it as a shared responsibility model because the costs ultimately will be passed on to the consumers who, in you know, some sense, should be paying for an environmentally sound disposal, and that's a shared responsibility model. So I would take issue with that statement and just wanted to put that on the record.
Madam Chair, I think he's just referring to the lamps, not the e-waste.
Right, so but I'm saying that is actually not a true statement because we do have a model for lamps, but we do have a model here in the state where
I understand.
It's worked, and that was part of the premise, is it is a shared responsibility because the costs eventually will be passed on to the consumer to pay for the proper disposal of those items. But anyway, thank you for coming forward providing this to the committee. And next up, see, I'm trying to jump back and forth here a little bit since we have two sheets. I will call up, I think what I'll do next is call up Jim Craven. Let's do a couple from each. And Jim, are you here just on 320?
Primarily.
Okay. And why don't we have Holly Sears and Jeff Bissonette? It's like this is like the e-waste reunion right here.
And how much fun we've had, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
You say that with such sincerity, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Jim Craven representing the organization now known as Tech America, which is the rebranded American Electronics Association that I've been with for the last 20 years. We merged with another group, and so we are now Tech America forevermore in this building. Same folks. The reason we're here today is that I don't represent any battery manufacturers per se, people that actually make batteries. I think it's time we get a little bit into some of the weeds of what the bill actually requires. We can only testify on what's printed in front of us. Certainly, we're all believers in product stewardship and doing the right thing. Senate Bill 320 presents some specific issues, and they're outlined in my written testimony. I won't hit them all, except to say that I think there are some differences between this and what we did with e-waste. Primarily, I think the bill that we successfully passed in 2007 in this session with the chair's sponsorship did result out of a long conversation, some would say overly long conversation, that sort of led up to a successful bill. We've had a couple of meetings in the fall prior to the session with DEQ on product stewardship in general, a little bit of dialogue about batteries, but certainly not that sort of pre-work and bringing parties together for a common solution that we did have on e-waste. I realize that there are some consumers out there asking what I should do with these products. I don't think it at all is at the level that we all were hearing from citizens of Oregon asking for a solution, because this stuff was big and bulky and it was taking up their attics, basements, and garages, and they wanted to know what to do with it. I'm not sure we're hearing that kind of, that's not the only reason to take action, but I don't know that it has risen to that similar level as we certainly saw with computers and television sets. In the testimony provided by the RBRC in their printed testimony, and testimony they gave last week on a different bill in the House, I think they cited that 0.01% of the municipal waste stream is rechargeable batteries. So it is a tiny fraction. And really, the nut of this bill is, should industry step up and do the right thing? And I think you've heard almost overwhelming testimony that that has already happened. One of the reasons sometimes industry does step up, quite frankly, is preclude a whole bunch of conflicting state programs and regulations. On that chart you have where it shows older battery bills at the state level, that was mainly the debate over alkaline batteries, which did contain mercury. A lot of that was preempted when the federal government stepped up and passed what's called the Federal Battery Act. So really, there is a state bill in California, much less prescriptive than Senate Bill 320. Senate Bill 320 is copied almost primarily from an ordinance in New York City, and it has a lot of specifics that some of my people like Apple Computer and Motorola and Hewlett-Packard, who by this bill would be called battery manufacturers because they include batteries in their products. That's part of the, it's part of just a clarity issue, I think, for some of our folks. But I think what the industry has done is do everything you would want an industry to do for product stewardship. It has set up a statewide program and a national program. Its volumes, 70,000 pounds a year in Oregon, almost doubled in the last 4 years. So they're making progress. They are ubiquitously almost everywhere. They seem to be doing the thing you'd want to do if you started from scratch and there was nothing in existence. What you'd get, I think, is what you have. So the bill has some specificity, I know, directed at retailers. And I have some members who are actually retailers, as well as producers of electronic products, thus some of our concern. Down to the level of you have to have a sign at or near the point of entry. It says the size it has to be, what size the letters have to be, what words have to be on that sign. I mean, there's some specificity here that we don't normally impose upon people when we're trying to work collaboratively to find a solution. And I know maybe there are options to change some of that. There's also a disposal ban, which hasn't really been spoken to on the battery part much at this hearing. Again, because I think the bill was legislative council probably lifted it mostly from a New York law. The language in the bill that makes no relationship to the existing product disposal ban in the ORS. So that's, I think, flawed, would need to be fixed if that was the goal. But I think at the end of the day, what the battery industry is doing is getting greener, you know, part of the idea of product stewardship is to require manufacturers to get rid of their toxics. That's happening. They're stepping up with ubiquitous program to take back products. They seem to be doing everything you'd want. And so I think I'll close with perhaps a little bit of a perverse message that a bill like this presents. It's that if an industry steps up for the last 10 to 12 years to do the right thing, government still feels it needs to step in and help it be perfect. So I think that's the debate in front of you. Not that people aren't doing the right thing, but does this program need the act of government to tweak it, to compel retailers to do certain things, to get perfect? So whether perfection is the enemy of the good, I guess I'll leave you with that thought.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Holly?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, known as ORA. ORA is a statewide trade association representing private solid waste management companies in Oregon. I'm here today to speak to both Senate Bills 742 and 320. ORA appreciates the efforts of DEQ and the committee for considering a product stewardship approach to managing the waste stream. We have 2 points about product stewardship that we would like the committee to consider. First, product stewardship sites that collect waste for a product stewardship program should be required to obtain a solid waste permit. Requiring that sites adhere to environmental management practices only does not ensure the same environmental protections as does a solid waste permit. It is not our intent to burden nonprofits or others that would like to serve as collection sites for these products by requiring them to obtain a solid waste permit. However, it is our intent to ensure that these collection sites go through the proper permitting process in order to effectively manage highly toxic materials, as you heard about today. The nature of these products and what is contained therein does not change just because they are diverted from a landfill to be accepted at a collection site for recycling. Taking these products out of a permitted landfill to be placed at a non-permitted facility for recycling contradicts the environmental concerns that are the very basis for the product stewardship approach. Second, if a landfill ban is to be considered, it should be placed on the generator of that waste, not the disposal site. If generators of this waste decide to dispose of it, absent asking them if they have such waste at the entrance of the disposal site and educating the public on the benefits of recycling, the landfill operators have little control over that decision to dispose of it. Batteries are small and hard to see, and light bulbs are very small and easily breakable. Requiring transfer station operators and landfill operators to monitor and retrieve these products at disposal could threaten the safety of landfill and transfer station employees. The may not knowingly dispose of standards in Senate Bill 320 is a difficult standard to apply to transfer station and landfill operators because in most cases, by the time the operator becomes aware of the material has been disposed of, it is too late for the employee to retrieve that material because doing so could put their health and safety at risk or it could put the employer in possible violation of OSHA regulations. So at that point, it is safer for the material to be disposed of in a safe and properly permitted landfill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Holly. Jeff, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. Just a quick note of support for Senate Bill 742, the lighting bill. As was testified to earlier, more and more consumers are using compact fluorescent light bulbs, or CFLs, in their homes, in their businesses, and that's a good thing. They use much less energy and really help to bring down energy loads. However, they do last much longer than regular incandescents. However, at some point, they do run out. They do need changing, and you need to do something with them. And so the main message I bring here today is help consumers do the right thing. there are consumers out there, not just Senator Walker, but other folks that have called our office, you know, really wanting a discussion about the pros and cons of CFLs, and we really try and underscore that they are very important, but people are concerned about what to do with them and what happens with the mercury and that sort of thing. So it is a consumer concern out there. There was a note about cost earlier. I think the chair noted that, you know, consumers do bear the cost one way or another. I'd agree with that. And you know, in terms of what is quickly becoming a national product, it's not just Oregon consumers that are bearing that cost. It's consumers across the country. So here, basically, to encourage your efforts on this bill, and please help consumers do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And when here, quick question for you. When people do call, where do you send them? About where to dispose of their fluorescent compact fluorescent lights.
Madam Chair, if they live in the metro area, we actually have them call Metro. And if they do not, we have them call their local county disposal agency. And we help them, you know, look it up and you know, identify that to the best of our ability and invite them to call back if we hit that wrong. But mainly a lot of it is just, well, should I just really use incandescents? And it's like, no, you really need to use CFLs because, again, they do use less energy, they're cheaper over time, they last longer, and it puts off this decision. But again, we started using them in pretty mass quantities back in the energy crisis of 2001, 2002. So we're starting to see some of those light bulbs, you know, run their course. And so this is going to be an issue that, you know, is going to be to tag on to the volcanic analogy of earlier, is going to be sort of exploding onto the scene here before too long.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the Citizens Utility Board. Yeah. Can you envision how enforcement is going to work? I mean, you represent the citizens. If the light bulb gets thrown, it's a $500 fine for the citizen who threw it in the garbage. And if there are three batteries, it's $350 fine. So any grasp of how that might be enforced or...
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, to be frank, no. And on the battery side, I'm not. I'm you know, truly agnostic, at least as far as my organization goes. Again, I think the spirit behind my remarks is help consumers do the right thing and give them options. If they do that, I think people will do the right thing. And so I think, you know, hopefully enforcement will take care of themselves. I think then enforcement needs to be focused on people who are you know, being out and out negligent or not, you know, recognizing that there is a problem. So I don't have a particular comment on you know, the current form of the bill. If in the judgment of the committee that needs to be changed, we have no problem with that.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. if I may help. Jim Craven, Tech America. I admitted in summarizing my testimony, we usually have to testify on the printed bill that's in front of us, and 320 has a sort of a perverse wrinkle in that because it only focuses on rechargeable batteries, there is still some mercury, very tiny bit, in some of the button batteries, the hearing aid batteries and such, that's not been eliminated, to my understanding. Since this bill does not cover those kinds of batteries, you could throw away a mercury-containing device in a landfill, and it'd be fine, but if you threw away a lithium-ion battery that has no heavy metals in it, you'd be penalized. So, you know, the words are important, and the details do get important when we, you know, go through the whole bill and look at all the pieces in it.
Thank you.
And I don't know how you'd enforce a button battery tossed in your trash and thrown away.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we're going to hear from, now, Betsy Earls, you've signed up for both bills. You want to come up? And then I have Joan Powell. Is that right, Joan? John, sorry. I thought it was, you know.
Brother John's here.
It looks like I thought there was a new person here. You brought your sister. And then we'll call up Brock Howell. Brock, are you still here? Okay. All All right, Betsy, why don't you go first? And just since the hearing is open for both bills, certainly you can just tell us which ones or you want to testify on first.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and AOI's Retail Council, and I can just testify on, I think I'll just start with Senate Bill 320, if that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
AOI has over 300 members who identify themselves as retailers, and those are companies of all sizes and from all different places around the state. The AOI Retail Council is opposed to Senate Bill 320's collection requirements and recycling requirements, which place all of the onus for battery collection on retailers. Imposing the requirements of Senate Bill 320 on Oregon's retailers completely ignores the existence and success of the RBRC program and other programs being run successfully by manufacturers and users of rechargeable batteries in this state and places an unrealistic burden on those businesses. Senate Bill 320 impacts retailers twice. First, the bill sweeps many of them into the definition of battery manufacturer, thus requiring that they participate in funding the recycling program envisioned by the bill. Second, the bill places extremely prescriptive requirements on almost all stores regarding the placement of collection bins and signage. Senate Bill 320 requires, in effect, that Oregon retailers create, pay for, and operate a waste disposal program which is focused on just one product, batteries. This is costly, duplicative, and unfair. Waste disposal has traditionally been a government responsibility paid for through public taxes.
Betsy, can I just, I'm going to interrupt for a minute because I think we heard from the gentleman on the phone in, from back east that they pay for the program. So I just wanted to find out if that's different from for RBRC. If you're a member of that program, they said they pay for all the costs.
Yes.
Okay, so I just heard you say that.
I don't think all retailers in Oregon participate in the RBRC
program. But if they do participate, then
yes,
they get all their costs covered.
Yes, I would agree with you there.
Thank you.
Certainly. Governments around Oregon have, in fact, taken an active role in managing battery disposal in their waste streams, and to transfer this function to Oregon's retailers is a difficult and costly proposition. I would also like to take a moment and register our opposition to Senate Bill 742, just in terms of including retailers in the definition of producer, which means that they will be responsible for creating and maintaining the stewardship program that's envisioned in the bill. Our position, again, is that waste collection is the financial responsibility of Oregon's governments and that instead of putting the cost of these programs on the business community, it's more appropriate to make them compete for public resources with other programs with similar issues. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to, because we just heard, and I want to make sure that I was hearing right.
Yes, I'm on the same page.
Okay. John.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Transform from Joan.
I'm John Powell, representing AT&T, and joining me in representing AT&T in Oregon is Elise Brown, and she actually wrote my name on that paper, so it wasn't my handwriting.
It looks, yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, it looks like a Joan writing. That's
doesn't
why.
It look like Joan?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay.
So Elise is to blame.
She's to blame. Yep. It's totally her fault. Madam Chair, members of the committee, AT&T and the wireless phone industry has a take-back program that they're extremely proud of, and the all wireless carriers serving in Oregon, the national carriers, voluntarily take back each other's products and accessories, including rechargeable batteries. And, of course, under Senate Bill 320, a cell phone retailer becomes a manufacturer and subject to the bill. And Madam Chair, on that point, we would be glad and would like to participate in any kind of a work group that's formed on this bill, because I think there are some things in there that would probably cause us to alter or drop many of the attributes of our existing program. The take-back program has not been in existence as long as the RBRC program. However, it is making good strides in recycling. Not only is there an obvious opportunity for a consumer when they're changing phones to recycle by simply letting the store have it. You can go online and get free postage paid labels to mail them in to any of us. Manufacturers,
John, when you say any of us,
any of the wireless companies, AT&T, T-Mobile, okay. Verizon, and Sprint.
And you pay for shipping?
Yes, it's postage paid. The manufacturers, including Motorola, Apple, have the same policies and take back each other's equipment as well. We also participate in the EPA regulations for managing end-of-life electronics. But beyond just already having a take-back program, these companies, all four of the major companies, have charitable programs they actually fund with the proceeds from recycling. And AT&T uses the proceeds to fund free long-distance calling cards for soldiers to keep in touch with their families. Sprint funds internet safety programs for kids. T-Mobile provides financial support for programs for at-risk youth. And Verizon provides refurbished cell phones to victims of domestic violence. So, again, we think we have stepped up, and we think our program has merit. And the industry's program is free to the consumer. It's easy, and it benefits great causes. And we would hope that going forward we could use the resources from this program to continue the charitable programs as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell again, and I'm with Environment Oregon. And I'm testifying in support of both bills. We as an organization, have made a special emphasis to approach global warming and to solve it through many different policies, including energy efficiency. So CFLs are definitely a critical component for providing a new economy that will help us achieve reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Important in this context, though, is not to be singular on our issues. And we need to make sure whatever approach we take towards solving our greater problems for the climate, that we're not harming our water and our soils and the health of our future children. What these two bills are an approach to get at is to make sure we have a systematic approach towards recycling or disposing of our products. In this case, rechargeable batteries and lights that contain mercury. I don't think it's quite fair to state that just because we haven't had a program for the past 10, 50 years on these issues to make sure that private parties, that manufacturers have been bearing the cost that has been brought down the chain, that we shouldn't now institute a system to make sure we incentivize the market to appropriately consider these social and environmental costs. So I think these two bills go a long way to ensuring that manufacturers consider the costs, and that way we have a proper way to dispose of and recycle our products. And so that is why Environment Oregon is supporting these bills. I think this is a great opportunity for Oregon to lead on product stewardship, and I thank you very much for your time on this issue.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these witnesses? Okay, you guys got off easy. Thanks. And our last folks up, is Mike Dewey still here? Okay, so Fawn, and then I have Michael Mason and Louis Pitt from the Confederative Tribes of Warm Springs. Why don't you guys come up as well? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fawn McNeely, and I'm here representing NFIB. NFIB opposes both Senate Bill 320 and Senate Bill 742. Our members are very concerned this session about any legislation that will increase the cost of doing business in Oregon. We feel both of these bills will put an undue burden on small retailers at a time when they can least afford increased regulations. On the I'll start with Senate Bill 320. Betsy covered some of our concerns that AOI has about this bill. We did want to point out the bill does not reference RBRC, and therefore we think that there would have to be some kind of language that protects retailers if the program doesn't actually work for those retailers. For every rechargeable battery that's used, we avoid the use and disposal of a great number of regular batteries, and we have concerns that the effects of this bill may discourage retailers from offering for sale rechargeable batteries at all, the small retailers.
Ron, do you know how many of your members are already participate?
I do not have that information, but I can check into it for you.
Okay, thanks.
On 742, we have specific concerns about the impact of Section 8 on small retailers. This section includes a requirement that retailers constantly check a DEQ-approved website before placing orders for products in the bill. And for a small retailer, we just feel like this could be an added burden that, and they could ultimately be subject to penalties. We also have concerns about the recycling information distribution component of the bill. And for these reasons, we oppose both of the bills.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Fond? Okay. Thank you very much. Last but not least, thank you for coming.
All right.
Louis.
Thank you. Louis Pitt, Jr. I am Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. We're in support of 742. Our strength, I was talking to a coworker of mine about talking about who Warm Springs is when it comes to environment. Our strength is kind of a broad resolution over a large-scale land of low tech. And we're trying a real high-tech venture with Fish Passage, and I'm holding my breath on that. But we've gone any and everywhere to talk the gospel of protecting the environment. And so this is one of those I think that will help. And mercury is something that's in the system, the light bulb. And what do we do about it is really dependent on a lot of things. But now is as good a time as any to start, and I think we have a lot of work to do. I'm very pleased with, I think, the systematic approach that I know with, Chair Dingfelder understands, it's not an easy solution no matter how we look at these things and in the environment, and just that resource background really gives me confidence that there will be a workable and effective solution. We cancer. Tribal folks eat a lot of fish, more fish than the normal average, I think, or at least Oregonian citizen. We had a study happen here a while back where I think the DEQ tried to say 8 ounces was the average amount of food that people eat salmon. Well, we eat about 20 ounces. We love our salmon. And I saw a DEQ guy when we had a salmon bake here had clearly over that 8 ounce limit that he was supposed to eat. So anyway, I think that proved our point. And so our major, you have salmon in the morning when you eat at my house, salmon in the noon, and salmon at night. And if you get up and have a snack, you'll probably have some more salmon. And so this weekend, too, we're having a first fish ceremony up at Celilo Falls. We're dependent upon all of the governments in Pacific Northwest to do what they can to protect all of our ways of life. So this is one of those, I think, that would help that. So thank you.
Thank you, Louis. Appreciate you coming. Michael, did you want to say a few words?
Just a few, Chair Dingfelder. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 742. For the record, my name is Michael Mason, here also representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. So, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, we applaud you for considering this bill, considering a method of product stewardship for mercury-laden items like light bulbs. As you know, we've been active on this mercury issue for some years before the Legislative Assembly and on encouraging your efforts to deal with other toxins and pesticides and so forth. I wanted to mention something that I need to follow up with your counterpart, Chair of the House Environment Committee. Some have made the point, well, you know, really what's the problem here? 3.5 milligrams of mercury in a light bulb, so what? 3.5 milligrams is enough in certain forms to harm small children, to harm the brains of small children, certainly fetuses. When you start to talk about millions of bulbs, it gets very serious. 1 gram of mercury in a 20-acre lake contaminates all the fish in that lake to the point that none of them are safe to eat. I mean, you can't overemphasize how small an amount of mercury it takes to cause harm. So, and it just doesn't go away. Again, we thank you for considering this and urge you to support this product stewardship effort.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And anybody else that would like to testify on either Senate Bill 742 or Senate Bill 730 before we close the public hearings and open up our last public hearing?
Madam Chair, before you close, are we at some point going to have the DEQ come up and talk about the light bulb police and the battery police and how they intend to enforce
it? If you would like to, I can call Palmer up before the gavel goes down. Talk about enforcement on these two bills, I think that would be.
Madam Chair, I'm not so much interested in industry. I'm interested in both bills have the common citizen with fairly substantial fines, $500 for a light bulb and upwards of $350 for a battery.
Again, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason with the Department of Environmental Quality. I think, Senator, you raise an excellent issue. These are small products that can easily get thrown in the garbage. And so I think mistakes can be made about placing these things in the trash, as well as, quite frankly, I don't know that DEQ has the resources to chase down everybody who might either accidentally or intentionally dispose of these things and the waste. So I'm just going to be very frank with you. I think what would probably happen is DEQ would use the limited enforcement resources we have to go after people who are really abusing it, really throwing large amounts of either lighting or rechargeable batteries away. I think that's most likely what would happen in those instances. And from the department's perspective, if those are sections of the bill that we need or bills that we need to look at, we could certainly be willing to do that. I know in the e-waste law we worked with the landfill operators to address their concerns that they would be liable or responsible for even a computer, which is a much larger item, being thrown into a ton of trash. And it's not really reasonable for them to try and screen all that out. So I think there's some creative ideas that we could approach those issues, but you raise a good point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And don't move, because we're going to quickly open up the next hearing, and I think you'll want to be up there for that. So with that, I will close the public hearings on Senate Bill 742 and 320, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 843. We just have a couple of folks, Gary Hansen and Holly Sears. You guys all come up together, and we'll have the department up here as well. Yes, Beth.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 843 requires persons engaged in businesses of selling, leasing, servicing, repairing, or managing motor vehicles to ensure that certain used oil filters are received and processed by oil filter processors, prohibits persons from disposing of, and prohibits disposal site operators from knowingly accepting for disposal any used oil filters at solid waste disposal sites.
Okay, thank you. And you probably get the theme today. It's Recycling Day. We also had Daryl Fuller, who wanted to testify but had to leave, so he submitted written testimony for the record. So, and thank you for being here. I just want to recognize former Representative Gary Hansen, who I served with over on the other side, and it's great to see you back here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be on this other side.
Having a real job.
Yeah. The basic purpose of this bill is to get the residual.
Can you say your name, Gary?
Gary Hansen from Portland, Oregon. The purpose of this bill is less in terms of keeping a hazardous waste out of the landfill, although that is certainly a byproduct of it. When a consumer changes the oil in their car, or it's changed, there's a residual amount of oil that stays in the oil filter. That oil can be reused. It can be recycled. It is comprised of about the most valuable part of crude oil. There's only about 1% of crude oil that can actually be used for lubricating purposes. So the purpose of this is to try and capture that last little bit of oil so it can go back into the system, be reused, and continue being used over and over and over again. So it's much more based on sustainability than just keeping something bad out of the landfill. There have been some issues that have came up with one of my clients, so I haven't had an opportunity to really work this bill like I had intended to. But I think there are some issues with enforcement and issues with administration with DEQ that we're very willing to meet with and work with and hopefully come up with some answers that can make this pretty much a consensus bill. And hopefully we can reschedule it at a later date to pound out some details and give you a consensus bill that really won't have a lot of controversy to it.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. DEQ's up there more for if we have questions.
Holly Sears. Oh. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Holly Sears for the record with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. And really our concerns with Senate Bill 843 are the same as the concerns that I shared in my last testimony for the previous two bills, and that is the disposal ban piece especially. If you look at an oil filter, they are pretty small, unlike other products such as e-waste that do have disposal bans. And they're very difficult to retrieve once a generator of that waste, a consumer of that product, decides to throw that in their curbside garbage. So we request that the landfill ban be carefully considered, and we would be happy to work with you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And while I have DEQ up here, could you tell us, did you have any
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Palmer Mason, Department of Environmental Quality. I think there's several issues that I'd like to speak to. I think that Gary is right. There's certainly valuable resources in these used oil filters, both the oil and the metal that helps make up the filter, and that's worth salvaging. It's our experience that that's largely happening anyways, that at least at the commercial level, the people who routinely service vehicles are turning the used oil filters over to various processors and others who recover the oil and recover the scrap metal. That's not to say that this current system can't be improved, but our experience and understanding is that that's largely happening anyways. The second thing there was a couple specific things in this bill that would, from our point of view, need to be looked at. One is there's no definition of a used oil processor. And so we're not clear what the size of the universe is. Is it a handful of companies that Mr. Hansen referred to who are largely in the business of only dealing with used oil processors, or are we also talking about the scrap metal dealers who routinely handle this product, and would they need to also register as well? And that becomes important for the third reason, and that is there's no fee authority in this bill for DEQ to manage the cost, and since we will have to set up a registration system, that will entail developing a database and a process to go along with that, and there's no ability to cover the costs for that those issues. So just wanted to get those on the record.
Okay, thank you. I did have a question if you knew what percentage of oil filters are being recycled now.
But Madam Chair, I'll do my best to find out. I don't know that we have that information, but I can try to find out.
Okay, thank you. And I was remiss in not saying that Senator Haas is a co-sponsor of this bill, so did you want to say a few words on it? Okay. He's all greased up and ready to go. Any questions for any of these witnesses?
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay, just one very brief comment. Listening to all this compelling testimony this afternoon, there are significant numbers of amount of salt in some of these, in some of the used oil. And so possibly the committee might want to package all of these together in a salt and battery bill and refer it to judiciary.
I'm sure that the Chair Przanski would be happy about that one.
I'm a no on that one.
Okay. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 843, and we are actually done earlier than I had anticipated with the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Yes, we are efficient. So I'll see you next Tuesday.